Welcome to Get to Work Hurley, your podcast for pro writers, fans, and geeks of all sorts. On this episode, she is a Hugo and Nebula nominated author, with stories published in numerous magazines such as Analog and Uncanny, and on Tor.com, and in several anthologies. Her latest book, Loca, part two of the Alloy Era series, Duopoly, is out now. Please welcome to the show, SB Dibia. And now your host, Cameron Hurley.
Thank you for joining us on this one. It is lovely, as I said, to see you again.
Yeah, it's so great to be here and to see you again. It's been far too long.
Far too long, for sure. How was Glasgow?
Amazing. Glasgow was super fun on most axes. There was one in which it was not great, which was wheelchair access. We can get into that later. Mm-hmm. But the experience, the con itself was wonderful. All my panels were brimming over with people. The vibe was good.
Good.
You know, there was not a lot of doom hanging over anyone and everyone. And Scotland is beautiful. It's my first time in the country, and I got to travel around before the con with my family for a couple of weeks. And really spectacular. I had a blast.
Oh, that's awesome. So I want to talk about, so what number book are we on here with this one that just came out with Loca?
It is two of two, basically. Okay. But this isn't really, I hesitate to call it a proper series. The second book takes place 15 years later and is about a very different set of characters than Meru. And while they are related and they inhabit the same universe, and there are some spoilers in book two for book one, you could absolutely read them in either order or entirely separate and still enjoy either one. I'm like, I've been telling everyone it's like peanut butter and chocolate. You know, it's better together with the chocolate on the outside, but you can really enjoy them just as well separately.
So what was the locus idea for, and we can even go back to the first book, for this world, for this series, like where was the big idea, right? Where did that start?
There were kind of two big ideas that came together. One was more, I guess, an inspiration for the story, which was this old mythological story from the Mahabharata that I'd always enjoyed as a kid. And it's about a couple, but it's not your typical Western romance structure. It's not about the couple getting together. It's really about what happens after they get together that drives most of the plot. So I hung a lot of my plot beats, you know, on that story. And then it gradually evolved from there to something very different. So it's not a retelling. It was an inspiration. And then the thing that really inspired the world building was I'd heard a person named Philip Goff talking about panpsychism and physics. And panpsychism is this idea of universally imbued consciousness, that everything, every object, every atom potentially has a degree of consciousness. And there are some physicists like Roger Penrose who, while they are not calling it panpsychism, are starting to think also that maybe consciousness is a fundamental property of nature and our experience of it emerges from our physical structures. And so I was like, well, what if, you know, 1,000 years from now, people have figured out that this is true, they know how to measure it, it's testable, etc. It's a scientifically and socially accepted concept. How would that change society? How would that change the way people interact with each other and their environment? And that kind of formed a lot of the basis for this alloy society and how the world works. And so both books, you know, really explore some of that philosophy, really explore some of the conflicts that it can cause between human nature and what would be expected and legal if these things were true.
And how did you then, I'm curious, because I actually just taught at the Alpha Writing Workshop. It was a bunch of young writers, like 14, 16. And I took them on the chaos that is my world building, which is let's throw a bunch of shit at the wall and see what happens. And I'm curious, when it comes to world building, are you someone who spends a lot of time before you start saying, okay, here's this big idea. Now, how would this change a lot of, you know, the world? Or are you someone who sort of organically, you know, walks through that and does it as an iterative process or something else? I'm curious how you take that.
I generally like to spend some time upfront developing the world, definitely, thinking about the society, right? Like I'm definitely a what if science fiction writer for my science fiction, and honestly, even for a lot of my fantasy. But what if this was true, right? Then what? What are the consequences? So I like to kind of think about some of those consequences up front in terms of, you know, politics, science, technology, social interaction, art, like all the different aspects of society, right? But then I do have an iterative process, and I call it my triangle because I have one vertex is the characters, a second one is the plot, and the third is the world building. And I kind of iterate between those three. So it's like I have my idea, then I figure out who my main characters are that I want to kind of explore this idea through. And then I figure out the plot that I want to structure that story around. But usually each one influences the other. So there are certain things I might need to happen in the plot, which require me to adjust the world building. There are things that I might, you know, characters I might have to introduce or personalities that might have to change in order for, you know, some of the other two aspects to work out. And so I kind of, yeah, I learned my lesson with my debut novel, Machinehood, which was the first novel I ever finished writing. And I mostly pantsed it. I did a lot of world building up front, but I did not figure out the plot. I didn't iterate. So I ended up rewriting the book several times before it actually all came together. And I kind of hated that. So I was like, I never want to do this again. So with Meru, when I started working on the ideas for the book, I was like, I'm going to outline this sucker for the next 6 months. I will not write a single word of the draft. Like, I just didn't allow myself to, but I could write notes. I outlined, you know, chapter by chapter. Like with Machinehood, I learned how to reverse outline, right? Like, I went through each chapter, summarized it, figured out where my beats were versus where they should have been, etc. So, and then I iterated that outline and the characters and the world building notes for 6 months. And then I sat down and I wrote the whole book in probably about 5 months, spent maybe a couple months revising. And my agent was like, yeah, this is pretty much good to go. So I was like, yes, that worked much better. Much
better. Yeah.
So I've discovered that I'm because I don't like rewriting, pantsing is not well suited to my nature. And I do love the research and I do enjoy the planning stage. It doesn't take away from the love of putting down the prose, because that's a different part of my brain for me.
Now I want to talk about I love that you've got that process down. It's like, okay, I'm just going to spend 6 months and I'm going to know what I'm doing. And then I'm just going to do it, right? A planner, right? And then I'm going to do it.
Right.
So now, and there's something, again, a lot of writers are struggling with now, which is long COVID. And I know that you are, you know, a writer affected by it. And I'm curious just how do you plan your day or plan your process around, again, energy levels? How are you managing to make that work, you know, while dealing with something like long COVID?
So the second book, Loca, which just came out, is something I 100% worked on after I developed long COVID. When I got sick in early January, like pre-vaccine, pre-everything, right? And then thought I made a full recovery and then had a major crash and have never walked back from that. And I stopped writing at that point probably for a good 3 months, because I was just dealing with a lot of medical appointments. I didn't know nobody, you know, when things first start going wrong with you, people, even at that point, didn't automatically jump to long COVID. They were like, we're going to check your lungs and your heart and, you know, brain. And so I was going through a battery of tests. until we ruled out everything else. So the first things I actually wrote after that, the very, very first thing was not science fiction. It was a fantasy, historical fantasy retelling of Rumpelstiltskin. And I really wanted, there's something I'd kind of been noodling with for several years. And I was just coming out of such a dark place emotionally that I was just like, I just want to chill, you know? I just want to write something that maybe will never see the light of day and just enjoy it and just relax. And I had Meru on submission at that point and was collecting a lot of rejections. So that wasn't fun either. I didn't know where my career was going. And so I sat down and wrote what ended up being a novelette. And I'm partway through writing it. The editors of Uncanny asked if I'd be one of their solicited authors for 2022, and ultimately ended up picking up that novelette, and it went on to do very well. So all happy ending, but you know, I knew none of that, right? When I embarked on it, it was really like, I don't have the brain for research. I don't have the attention span for writing anything dark. I don't have the spoons, the emotional capacity for it. So I just wanted to do something fun. But that kind of eased me back into things. And then later that year, I got this 2-book deal. So my publisher picked up Meru and they agreed to have a second book as part of that universe. And after I finished the edits for Meru, I took a very similar approach to Loca. There was a decent amount of world building I didn't need to repeat because it was same universe. But I'm very bad at not world building for my books because that's one of my favorite aspects of writing speculative fiction. So I decided with the second book, unlike the first book, which mostly was much more of a space opera, there's a lot of space travel, there's other planets, there's other solar systems, there's all kinds of stuff happening off Earth, right? So I decided in the second book that I really wanted to explore what life on Earth was like. So it's a very sort of around the world in 80 days travelogue type of story. And naturally, I had to do some world building for that. And I had to do a decent amount of research because it's taking place on real places on Earth. And I wanted to, for myself, really think about what life in those places might be like 1,000 years from now, you know, under the aegis of this new social structure. And so I did still spend a decent amount of time figuring that out, as well as outlining my plot. That plot outline saved my butt in a big, big way, because when I sat down to start drafting it as the first novel I had drafted since developing long COVID, what I very quickly realized was that I couldn't remember what I had written the day before. And so, you know, I could either sit there and read, but reading is draining too, because that requires a certain amount of brain processing power. And so having the outline and keeping that outline up to date as I went through and wrote gave me a much easier shortcut to be like, okay, what happened in the last chapter? Like, what are the key things that I need to remember before, you know, I start this next scene or this next chapter or whatever. And I wasn't 100% faithful to the outline. I never am. But I keep the outlines as tabs in a spreadsheet. So it's like, you know, version 1, version 1.2, et cetera, version 2. I come from a tech and software background. So that's how my brain works. Yeah. So I would start a new tab, you know, every time I diverged from the outline and update what had changed. And the other thing I recognized was, before I got sick, I could sit for like a 3 or 4 hour block and do, you know, like 2 to 3 sprints, long sprints in there of writing. And that would be sort of my output for the day. Post having long COVID, it was like, I have a very slow start in the morning. So I would usually do an hour in like late morning, kind of around this time when I'm talking to you, when brain had warmed up, everything was functional. And then I would take a long break in the afternoon for about 3 or 4 hours and then do another hour in the afternoon if it was a good day. And between those two, I could usually manage 500 to 1,000 words most days, especially again, it's nice writing from an outline because I knew what needed to happen, what I needed to lay down. But all that said, it was still really hard because while I was writing it, I basically couldn't do much in the way of reading. I couldn't do much socializing. I couldn't play a lot of video games, which requires a lot of hand-eye coordination. My symptoms manifest in a myriad of ways, as they do for a lot of people. It's a little bit different for everyone. For me, it's turned into ME/CFS or chronic fatigue syndrome. Plus, I have some neurological weirdness with my eyes. I have neuropathy, blood pressure issues that mean I have to kind of lie down or be reclined for a large part of the day. So what I learned in the first 9 months of being sick was my limits were a lot lower than I thought. And I kind of had this step down function for those first 9 months where be okay, then I do too much, develop worse symptoms, stabilize those, do too much, develop worse symptoms. And so at this point, I've kind of learned generally at home to manage my energy levels, to know my limits. I wear like two different monitoring devices, a Fitbit and a heart rate monitor to kind of keep track of everything. I've learned that I also have like a 2 to 3 day latency between when I overdo it and when I really crash, which is typical. People's latencies are anywhere from 24 hours to up to 5 days for some people. So you have to really be proactive at not doing too much. So it's like just because I'm in the flow today doesn't mean I keep writing. Like I have to cut myself off. And but it worked out. It was tough going. I had a draft done. Well, let me back up a bit. When I signed the contract in the fall of 2021, I hadn't figured all this out yet. And I wrote Meru in about 18 months, including the world building. So I thought I could deliver Loca in a year to my publisher because I was like, this is not as much world building. And, once I have the outline, I can knock a book out in 5 months. Well, it turns out that no, I can't do that anymore. I'm at about half the speed I was. So I ended up asking for an extra 6 months. And even then, I had to ask for yet another extra 4 months. After I finished the draft, I realized in revisions that it wasn't where I really wanted it to be. I could have turned it in, it would have been okay, but I talked to my editor and my agent, and they kind of said, let's pad it out another 4 months as long as that's it, and we don't have to push the date out a second time. Because they had already started pre-orders at that point. And I think that was really worthwhile because it took some of the pressure off me and I was able to give it to them in about 3 months and I was much, much happier with the end result. So yeah, I mean there's definitely been some learning along the way for me as well as to what are my limits, what are my limitations, what am I sacrificing in order to write a book. At this point, I turned in the edits for this earlier this year. And since then, I have not, well, up until last month, up until July, I had not written a word. I took some time to just read books and talk to my friends, because an hour long interview like this, or even, an hour and a half socializing with someone, that's an hour that I'm not writing that day. So it's all trade-offs at this point, and it's very much spoon theory for those who aren't familiar with it. It's like you have a limited number of clean spoons per day. Once they're all used up, that's it, you're done. So you have to decide, am I gonna eat pudding? Am I gonna eat ice cream? Am I gonna eat soup? It is what it is. And so, yeah, I think it's gonna be kind of I'm probably going to be in this sort of bursty format for a while, where once I'm in a project, I really have to just kind of focus on that and then take some breaks in between to do other things. So last month I agreed to a couple of solicited short story projects. So that's what I'm doing at this point. And then I'll figure out what my next book is going to be.
Very nice. Very cool. Yeah, no. And again, you know, your story's right, very similar to all the other folks that I have talked to, you know, affected by long COVID and all of that. And I continued, the fact that you said Glasgow still had wheelchair access issues enrages me, because we just had the same nonsense with Brighton and with all these other things. And I, yeah, that it's very frustrating.
It is, but some of it they can't do anything about, because in the UK they have, apparently they have to have fire doors that remain closed, like at every hallway, at the end of every hallway. And they have not retrofitted these spaces to have automated door openers. So that was a gigantic pain in the ass in a wheelchair. And then, but then there were other things that were just weird. Like there was a giant speed bump between the hotel, the main convention hotel, and the convention center. So it's like you could go outside over the horrible speed bump, which if you're not in a wheelchair, it sounds like it might just be kind of fun, but the wheelchair tips back, but then it tips forward and you feel like you're going to fall out of the thing. Or you could go through like four sets of fire doors.
Oh,
and an overhead passageway and two elevators to avoid the speed bump. And I just took my chances with the speed bump, because the other route was even more frustrating. And some of it, you know, at the end of the day, like there's only so much the organizers can do with these spaces, right? Like I feel for them too, because if the space doesn't exist yet that allows for smooth and easy wheelchair access, what is anyone supposed to do? It's not an easily tractable problem. I wish it was. At this point, I think it's more of a social obligation to make these spaces more navigable, more accessible, and to really think about investing money, right? Ultimately, that's what it comes down to, is you have to invest the money to put in the infrastructure. They did not have ramps for all the panel stages. They did have lifts for some of them. But yeah, I mean, I was there with Joe Walton on one of my, I think it was my last panel on robots. And she couldn't, you know, she couldn't make the step up, and someone had to come and bring an assistive device out especially for her. And it's like, why can't there be enough of these that it's just there available for everybody all the time? So yeah, and that comes down to money.
Yeah. Yeah, money, money and awareness, because I feel like if there's not an awareness, then no one, and you don't make enough stink about it, that people go, well, no one, right? It's like, where do we put the money? I think there's that too, is what this idea of how the money is spent and where it goes. So
right.
Yeah, it's an over, and like, again, to your point, bigger problem in fandom, but frustrating for everyone.
Frustrating. So. Yes. I wrote some of this, not wheelchair access, but in both Meru and Loka have protagonists with sickle cell disease. And so they are both disabled to different degrees. And one of the things I put into this far future world is that all disabilities and disorders are accommodated for as best as possible, in part because it's a genetically engineered future, but in order to avoid eugenics, they have rules in place that you must have a certain number of mutations, chance mutations, and that society will deal with the outcome of those and help those people and not simply try to eradicate disability from the gene pool. Because I think even as terrible as disability is, and none of us necessarily wants it, there are there are things we can all learn from it, both scientifically and experientially, emotionally, just to be better human beings, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Well, those are my questions, Tim. Did you have any questions?
Can you share the spreadsheet stuff that you do? Because I find that stuff fascinating. can you like post a sample somewhere? Because every writer has such a unique approach to it. And I sat at in the Columbus Book Festival was a couple of weeks ago, and it was Scalzi, Toby, and I can't pronounce her name. They were talking about their approaches, and the back and forth between Scalzi and Toby was so funny. Like you could tell Toby was getting like physically angry because John's like, "Well, I just kind of sit down and I have an idea and then I start writing and then it's done." And Toby's like, "You son of a," I'm like, "I sit there for months and spreadsheets and all this stuff." And the woman was just like looking at the two of them like, "Oh my God." Like, so I think that's really interesting that writers all get to the same endpoint, but get there completely differently.
Yeah. I guess I could share it somewhere. I don't know what, if anything, I'd have to strip out of it, because I mean both of these books are out published in the world at this point. But I don't know. I like process. I've always been a very process-oriented, systematic kind of person. And like I said, but the one time I tried to pants my novel, I learned my lesson. It was a hard lesson to learn. So I think if you're comfortable with spreadsheets, you know, it's definitely a way to go. It's one reason I don't do my world building and notes in Scrivener. Which, you know, a lot of people, I use Scrivener for the first time with Loca, and I do like some features of it. Like it lets you see, you know, keep track of word count per scene and per chapter, which I find really useful rather than having to do it manually and put it into my spreadsheet. But for my outlining, because I want to do revision, like version control, software version control has this concept that you know, every time you get to kind of a good place with your software, not a finished product, but stages as you're developing your code, you check it in to a system that then assigns a version number, so that as you develop it further, if you screw something up, you can easily go back or compare and see where you went wrong. I kind of ran with that concept for doing my outlines, in part because what I realized as I was developing my outlines is I would have an outline, then I'd go off and be doing something else entirely, you know, in the kitchen or driving or in my shower, and be like, oh, you know what would be really cool is if instead of A happening, B happens at this point, right? And then I would go and put B into my outline and then look at the consequences of B through the rest of the story. And once it percolated through the rest of the plot, I would suddenly get to point C and be like, oh crap, if I do B, I can't have C because it won't make sense anymore. And then so sometimes I'd be like, you know what, B is not a good idea. And so I would leave that as its own sort of dangling outline tab, as a different version of the outline, and then, you know, go back to A or find some other thing that I want to do that's a happy medium. And this way I didn't paint myself into dead ends as I was writing, because a lot of times as I'm writing, I also come up with like, gosh, wouldn't it be really cool if I did this instead of what I actually plan to do? And by just running that through an outline, I could then figure out, do I really want to do this, or is it going to be a bad idea later in the line? Like, is there something else I want to say that I'm going to lose because of this?
Okay. It was Yume Kitase. That's who I had to like go look it up. She was on the panel and she was great. I want to check out her books.
Her Deep book Sky, is amazing. Also, Stardust I met Grail, her at Glasgow. and she's also a great person.
She also uses spreadsheets. And like, I've worked in corporate America for 20 years. I kind of don't love spreadsheets. So I've never thought of using them as a writing tool.
You know, everybody has different ways. Like, I know a lot of people who like to do post-its, right, on boards for rearranging their plots. Mm-hmm. And I think that could work just as well, because you get to a post-it and then you could do a new set of post-its, or you could, you know, swap out your post-it with one of a different color for where you're going to change things, and then see how stuff will diverge down the line if you do that. So,
or three by five cards.
It doesn't have to be, or anything. Yeah, it doesn't have to be spreadsheet if you're allergic to spreadsheets. And I know you both know Mer, and she's very allergic to spreadsheets too. So.
Well, I'm looking over Cameron's shoulder and I'm like, are those writing schedule, or is that just for general scheduling?
No, they are. They're because here's my thing is that I sometimes have to see them in different formats. So I will put, like, I have those big like sheets of butcher paper and I'll put it up there. I have these 3x5 cards. I'll put it on there. I'll have it in a spreadsheet. I'll put it on there. Sometimes I need to look at them in different ways, because I think when you look at it differently, it sparks different connections. So, yeah.
We usually at this point in our program talk about what we've been reading, what we've been watching, what we've been listening to. It's pop culture pop quiz time. So Divya, what sort of pop culture have you been ingesting recently?
What media have I? So for once I have answers, because when I'm in the middle of drafting, it's like nothing. I have been seeing nothing except anime, which I watch with the family over dinner. I have been, The Dragon Prince season 6. We binge watched that on a down day in Scotland. I need rest breaks. So season 6 had just come out. It's really good. Better than seasons 4 and 5, dare I say. And very much looking forward to season 7. I've also been watching Scavenger's Reign, also on Netflix, which is really interesting. I'm only like maybe a third of the way in. It is a difficult show for me to watch because there's so much happening on screen to pay attention to, but oh my goodness, the world building, I have like serious professional envy. I'm just like, this is amazing. So that's been really cool. And then for reading, one of the books I read en route to Scotland was Reset by Serena Dolan, in part because she and I are doing a bookstore event in a couple of weeks. So it's the first book in a trilogy. Really cool central idea, which is that in order to prevent the recurring violence in human society that ultimately led to the destruction of most of the world, the remaining humans have agreed to have their memories wiped every 4 years. So they retain certain base skills, motor skills, language, that kind of thing, but they know nothing about their previous life or identity. And this happens to everyone at the same time. So everyone kind of wakes up and starts fresh every so many years, which I thought was such a great concept. And then I got to blurb Interstellar Mega Chef by Lavanya Lakshminarayan, which is coming out in November, which is a super fun sort of mashup of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and like Great British Baking Show or like Iron Chef. Wow. So highly recommend that people pick that up or pre-order it, pre-order it now for a few months from now. I have been reading a lot, so I'm like, I can throw out a lot of book names, but maybe I'll stop with those two and say movies. I don't know if I've seen any movies recently that I have really loved, but I've gone back to playing Genshin Impact as well. They're about to start a whole new region, and I played Chance of Sennar, which is, I feel like any writer who, or any person who's interested in language and linguistics, have you played it, either of you? Okay. Chance of Sennar, I have to yell about this game. I mean, I think it was nominated for both the Hugo and the Nebula Game Awards, because it is such a different kind of game, but it's basically, you know, you're dropped into this world where you don't know the language. And so it's very, like, graphically very simple, kind of 2D, or not 2D, but like the top down 3D. And the languages are written in unfamiliar characters, so it's not our alphabet either. And you have to, through context clues, decode what people are saying to you. And as you progress in each level of the game, you get exposed to a different society and a different language. And in the end, it all ties together. There's no fighting. There's some sneaking around. But it's really, like, largely like linguistics and puzzling things out. And it's just a really different, intriguing, fun game to play that I think it started on Steam and it's available for some of the consoles and PCs. I wish it was a mobile game because I would play through it a few more times. But yeah, for anyone, you know, especially I think those of us who really like playing with language, it's a really interesting game to play.
That's cool. I need to check that one out.
Cameron,
Yeah.
what's on your TV and your books and music and movies and that stuff?
Well, I've been reading a lot of nonfiction, actually. Speaking of language, I'm actually reading a book called Cultish by Amanda Montell, and it's about the language of fanaticism. So the way that cult leaders use that in language, right, and change the meaning of certain words and use certain phrases to signal, right, that we are a different group, we are, you know, all together. So it's that one's super fascinating. I'm about halfway through that one. And then I ended up yeah, reading a book called Smart Brevity, mostly for my day job. I do marketing copywriting, but just about how to get your emails read, basically, is to be as short and snappy and to the point as possible, which I think is in our attention starved culture. I think that it has some really valuable stuff to it. Then we watched a bizarrely wonderful show. It was like this psychological horror show called Braid last night, about these two young women who go to their childhood friend's house who's rich and want to steal all her money. But it descends into, which sounds like, okay, whatever, but it descends into like this psychological horror thriller stuff where you don't know what's really going on or what's doing what, and just it was wild. My husband knows how to pick them. That was a real trip last night. So that was delightful.
Excellent. You mentioned about the cultish book. Have you watched Dancing for the Devil, the 7M TikTok cult on Netflix?
I haven't. I watched Wild Wild Country though, because I grew up in the same time as the
Right.
issues. Yeah, in Oregon we're there. So I have watched that one. But yeah, no, I haven't watched the TikTok cult one yet.
That my wife and I just watched that. That was really interesting. Because it kind of goes against some of the cult not misconceptions, but ideas like, oh, preys on lonely people, preys on people who have trauma. Like in a lot of cases, these people who were got into this cult were from like very close, well-adjusted families, and they got sucked in through the dance. Like they're a part of a dance troupe, and then it sort of like closed in on them. It's the first thing I've seen about TikTok in that way. On the opposite side, my wife and I watched, and this was totally out of character, but we watched America's Sweethearts, the Dallas Cowboys Cheerleaders, which you're like, okay, what? And it's a competition show, sort of, about making the cheerleading squad, but they go very deep into the backstories of the women who are trying to join the squad, and they all have like amazing backstories. Where like one woman like lost her father and he took her to dance class when she was little and now she's like a dentist and she's always dreamt of being a professional dancer but this is the only opportunity that she really has. And the things that are crazy is like they get paid like $20 an hour, they work for 7 hours on a Sunday. This the dances that they do are so rigorous that most of them end up with like really bad hip and back issues because it's so violent on their bodies. And it's not 100% positive, which I was shocked. Like, they are very open about the fact that like, this is a little exploitive, but the Dallas Cowboys gave them complete access. So I don't think they realized what they kind of agreed to, because they have a lot of these like long lingering shots on people who are like, you know, they have an injury, or like the one woman, they're like, they have a glam day where they have all the women go to the salon and like do makeup and stuff. Cause you know, they have to be on camera for all the whole game, and they do events. And the one woman, they're like, we think you should go back to your natural brown. Like, we have a lot of blondes on the team. And then she hasn't even made the team yet. And she's like, okay. And then they cut her the next week after she changed her hair color. And you're like, you just had her change her hair color. And I was like, so mad. And I'm like, oh God, I'm invested in this now because they made her change her hair color. That was really unexpectedly interesting. And I also just started watching Girls 5 Eva. Have you guys watched that?
I think I watched like the first couple episodes.
It's from the brain trust of like 30 Rock and Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Mm-hmm. So it's a little hyper. It's a little like absurdist in some ways, but it's about Cameron, so you haven't seen it. It's about a early 2000s girl group, like teen girl group, 20 years later, and they're all living normal lives, and their song gets sampled by like a new hot hip hop artist. So they regroup because they now have this like, you know, popularity. And it's Sarah Bareilles, and they're all amazing singers for real. So it's Sarah Bareilles, Busy Phillips, Paula Pell, Renee, I always call her Gooseberry, but it's Goldsberry, I think, the mm-hmm. one who was in Hamilton. They're all amazing singers. They sing a cappella together all the time, but the music is so funny. And it's almost like, I don't know if you've seen Pop Star with Andy Samberg, which is a great mockumentary of pop music. The songs are just ridiculous. And we just like laugh out loud the entire time watching those. And then you mentioned Hitchhikers. I've only ever read the first Hitchhikers. So I got the actual, like the ultimate cool Hitchhikers guide, and I'm making my way through all of the stories right now.
Nice.
So that's what I've been ingesting, along with like finishing Reacher and some other things that I didn't finish, the second Reacher season was like, okay. Did you finish it, Cameron?
Nope. It's not what I'm here for. I was here for the first one, not here for the second one.
There were some good action sequences, but the story dragged. I was like, how many more episodes are like, really? We're going to stretch this over 8 episodes? Yeah. There was some cool, like, oh, that was an interesting way to kill somebody, but that was about it. So that's been my ingestion of pop culture recently. So we ready to wrap up?
I think we're ready, Tim.
Okay.
Cool.
You can find Divya at sbdivya.com, on Blue Sky, and on Instagram. What are your handles on those particular social sites?
I think Blue Sky, I managed to grab sbdivya, and Instagram is sbdivya_author.
Excellent.
But, you know, if people type sbdivya into the search, they'll come across me at some point. I didn't get it on Twitter because there was a school in India that had grabbed it. I'm certainly not the only SB Divya out there in the world. Divya is a very popular name in India these days. But, you know, I think there's only one of me that's a science fiction author.
Got it. You can find Cameron at CameronHurley.com, also on Blue Sky Instagram under the same name. If you're listening to this, you can watch the video and more exclusively at patreon.com/Cameron Hurley. You can join Hurley's Heroes to get short, gooey adventures from Cameron every month. And I just like to say I enjoyed having you both on because I got to charge you both for the admin work that I did. So I double billed on this episode. So I appreciate that.
You deserve it.
We appreciate you, Sam.
Thank you. You're helping pay for my vinyl record addiction. So I appreciate it. Cameron, send us home.
All right. Thank you for joining us all this month, everybody. And now get back to work.